Hello, everybody.
Hello.
It's Damon and with the Scream Team here today for review of Dr. Sleep. Is our
Mike Flanagan.
Mike Flanagan, and we are making this our first episode, bowing out with this one because we both got to see it over a week earlier than most people. By some stroke of fate, we both separately worked this out.
Oh, yeah, no, because I thought for a split second that you were going to be at the same theater that Ray and I were. Like, I completely forgotten that you were in Solar, so when I asked you, which theater are you at? I was like, maybe he'll come to the Warren, but you were at the Solar AMC instead.
I was incredibly shocked because Stillwater is a very little small outpost, a very small island between the metropolises of Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And to dream that anything like this would have came there was a long shot. And here they had it. Woe to the power of AMC as a banner to command such performances, even though there's not an audience to support it. I can tell you, at the screening I went to, I was very disappointed in this. There was all of 8 other people.
Oh, that's it?
I was really hoping for a packed audience, because you know how I am watching. This is why I'm such a proponent of the theatrical experience. I'm such a stodgy old dude in this that, like, you know, I really think movie releases should be staggered out far greater than they are before they ever hit home video, because I really want people to have to, like, get up off their butts and get to the theater, because the energy of other people sharing in the same experience you are, for me, it's all about the communal experience. Hearing other people's gasps and comments and everything about it, for me, that's what the theatrical experience is all about. It's wonderful. And so for something like this, as special to me as this is, this particular story, this adaptation, I really wanted a packed house. But I guess I'll get that in the coming week when it comes out again, because I will see it a second time. So what about you? For you, what was it like when you saw it? Was it pretty full?
Wasn't super duper packed, but it was, I guess, packed compared to that. A lot of people have brought what looked like little kids, which I was a little confused about. Like, I saw a little boy that looked like he was maybe 7 or 8. I was like, this is an R-rated feature. You positive you should be here? You absolutely sure? But then when we watched the film, I don't think there were really that many, like, unsettling scenes. I mean, there were definitely things that I don't think were appropriate for, like, an 8-year-old to see.
Yeah, there was, the little torture-y scene and a few instances of the F-word. You know, I counted 4 of them. But, you know, other than that, yeah, you know, it would have been okay, I should think. Certainly different than the time I saw the Friday the 13th reboot 10 years ago in theaters, and there were people there with their 5- and 6-year-olds, and incredibly gory, bloody, a fairly graphic sex scene. I had to wonder what those kids thought during that moment.
Well, parents have been bringing their kids to movies they probably shouldn't see since movies existed, so.
Yeah.
We cannot tell people how to parent their kiddos, and that's okay. That's another responsibility that I don't need.
True. All right, so initial impressions from you. I know you had not read the novel, correct?
No, and it's also been maybe not like a couple years. Less than that. I will say a handful of months since the last time that I watched any version of The Shining. I do prefer the Kubrick version. But even though that wasn't fresh in my mind, I still had an appreciation for the general narrative of Dr. Sleep, though. Which I was, and I was nervous going into it. I was like, man, is this experience going to suck? Because I haven't read the book, and I haven't watched, like, the first film installment in quite some time, but I found that that was not the case. I still really liked it.
When you say when you talk about different versions, are you talking about the Kubrick one versus the Mick Garris version, the TV movie from the late 90s, 97?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
See, I have never even seen that one because I've heard not so great things, and I'm afraid to, actually. While I was watching Dr. Sleep, I thought, I do need to get around to finally watching that version, but it's going to be one of those, I think it's going to be a chore in a way. I just have to do it to do it. Yeah.
Well, that was my first version of The Shining that I ever saw.
Are you kidding me? Wow.
Well, I think that one might be a little bit more, like, not as, like, disconcerting as the Kubrick version. But I've also not seen the TV movie version in even longer, so I really, really do not remember.
You know, I do know that the TV version, because King, I believe he was the screenwriter, the credited screenwriter on that one, he was so much about wanting something closer to his vision that he had had with the book that he, I'm assuming he pitched this. From what I remember, this has been 20 years, that he pitched this to the studios, to the television studios as a miniseries, this screenplay he wrote to try to make right. And Kubrick was still alive at this point, too, so, you know, it was kind of a, very much something that was relevant for the time, you know, try to make right on something. And I have read the novel, but, you know, shoot me, maybe I'm just a big film nerd. I much prefer the changes. I think the things that Kubrick changed about the story improved the story so much more. And I know there's a very vocal King fan base that disagree with that.
Do you mean improve the story, like improve the story overall, or improve the story for being like film material, you know?
I'm talking about, yeah, well, you know, for me it's both. It really, I do have, I mean, I will say, I'm not knocking the novel at all. I mean, I love King as an author. Some of his favorite books are ones that I follow, and when I read the novel, it haunted me for weeks. It really got under my skin, unlike anything ever has. And that was a very rather dark period for me anyway, but having read the novel then really helped color everything else that was going on in my life at the time. You know, in fact, this is when we were briefly roommates that I read that. That was a very dark period for me, and that was, the novel really got under my skin and just was kind of, it was, you know, and I recognize it as being this masterpiece that it is, but, you know, in terms of taking that to film, I felt like I'm in such awe of Kubrick. I think that Kubrick is just as much a master of cinema as King is to fiction, and if you're going to put this story up on the screen, I felt like every element Kubrick chose was just utter perfection. There's no way I can knock anything about the original film. And I've seen it dozens of times, theatrically even. And in fact, even as a four-year-old boy when the movie first was about to premiere and they were showing advertisements on television for the film, I kept seeing the silhouette of Jack carrying the axe as he's lumbering towards the maze. And because all you see is him in silhouette, it looked like he was riding the axe like it was a hobby horse. So I became obsessed with this story, and I wanted to see the movie so badly. And I would take a broomstick and I would ride around pretending I was Jack from The Shining, even though I didn't see the movie. I just knew what I saw from the, and I pretended I was roaming around with this axe after my family, and I'd be calling out the same things he was calling out on this preview. And I was intensely aware of the film as an entity and as a story, and I pretty much understood what the story was about at that age, just from a one-minute preview on television. And it wasn't until many, many years later I actually saw the full film. But, yeah, I had a whole early association with it. And I do remember a night when it first premiered on HBO. My parents were watching it with my uncle, aunt and uncle. And I remember getting up out of bed and lurking in the hallway and peering out to see the television to try to catch as much of it as I could, and until they would catch me, send me back to bed. And I kept getting up over and over. 5 or 6 times I got up and lurked in the hallway to try to catch more of the story.
I'm sure they found that very entertaining and not annoying at all.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it was an extreme annoyance at the time. And I don't know that it added anything to my understanding of the story. Like, there was so much. I think with Kubrick, he's so, with his perspectives, you know.
I would say he's very purposeful. He does everything so mega deluxe on purpose.
Well, this is the film where famously Scatman Crothers was forced to redo the same scene 87 times until he finally broke down in mid-scene and turned to Kubrick. "What do you want, Mr. Kubrick? What do you want?" And as Kubrick would say, he never knows until it happens. He's just going to keep putting people through the paces. Shelley Duvall famously had somewhat of a mental breakdown on the set because she was forced to do the same thing over and over and over. You know, I think one take, you know, she went over 127 times, or up to 127, before he finally got what he wanted out of her performance. And, of course, you know, he didn't know what it was until it happened. And he said, "Okay, that's it. That's the one I'm going with." So, yeah, just...
If I remember correctly...
Go ahead.
Well, just if I remember correctly, Jack Nicholson was not that kind to her either.
No, yeah, I understand.
As a coworker,
he somewhat stayed distant and in character.
Yeah, well, both of their performances were great. But
so, what is your? I know. Okay, so you said you started at the miniseries, and you obviously caught the Kubrick version at some point. What about the novels? Do you have any association with both of those?
I have not read either of them. I even own a copy of Doctor Sleep. It's somewhere in the room with me, and I still just haven't read it because I'm one of those people where I just collect books, and then I put them on the shelf, and they look really pretty, and then I just never read them. It's a problem.
Yeah.
And if I maybe had more time when I wasn't, with somebody, then I probably could have at least downloaded just an ebook copy and read it, but I didn't do that. So it's the continuing adventures of Morgan not being prepared in any way, shape, or form.
Well, even though I, even though I put off reading the actual novel for a very long time, I knew that it would be a rewarding experience when I did read it because of how different certain elements are. And I knew that that would be a whole experience of comparing and contrasting and trying to figure out which I preferred. The thing about Dr. Sleep is it's such a perfect adaptation. It would be a more difficult thing to jump into because then, you know, while there are many differences, they're very minor. They're not as major as the ones in the first adaptation. It would be a harder thing to pick up to read just for the sake of reading it at this point. But yeah, that's the thing I most appreciated out of all, is that Mike Flanagan not only adapted the story to the screen, which was all he was asked to do. I mean, that's anyone's expectation would simply be that. But he was smart enough to know that, hey, there are enough people out there that are just as much fans of the movie as there are of the novel, and we cannot ignore the iconography of that film. And even though King really disliked the adaptation that existed in the Kubrick form, you know, how do we merge those two worlds together? How do we even begin to make sense of things like, you know, the fact that the Overlook didn't burn down at the end of the movie, or the fact that what is his name? Scatman Crothers' character, Dick Halloran. The fact that he's, you know, at the beginning of Dr. Sleep, he's still alive, even though in the Kubrick film he gets axed by Jack towards the end. So, I mean, the conceits that he made to make it all work was brilliant. At the end of the original King novel, Jack, in a rage, goes down and, you know, sets to the furnace to burn the whole place down, just like Danny does in this film. And then we have Dick Halloran showing up time and again to counsel Danny in this one, but the conceit that Mike Flanagan uses to bring him back works so well, not only against the grain of the original novel, but also with the grain of the original novel, but also against it if you're looking at the Kubrick version.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
Are there more supernatural elements in the film, or are there more supernatural elements in the book?
For The Shining or for Dr. Sleep?
I'm curious about both.
I would say they're pretty even, but they're different. I feel like in the novel version of The Shining, there were more supernatural elements that were part of Jack's own perceptions, whereas in the Kubrick film, it seemed to be more just across the board a haunted house tale, to where everyone who was within that environment kind of uniformly experienced things, such as Wendy towards the end of the film when she's about to run out into the maze, and she pauses and she briefly sees the ghosts of some of the previous residents, Mr. Derwent and a party guest, and you know, one of them in a bear costume. You know, they are ghosts of the past, and that's something that, you know, that sort of thing, I think we don't really get the perspective so much of Wendy and Danny in the novel. It's sort of more from Jack's perspective. So, you know, it seems to be more inside his head. And I know that's the big beef King had with the Kubrick film, was that for him it was very much meant to be an allegory about alcoholism, and he really wanted to explore, you know, King wanted it to be less a tale of the supernatural and more about the demons of the mind, you know, with Jack. And I think Kubrick, you know, by showing some of these supernatural events as if they're more objective, that I think that's what King took issue with, was that, you know, you're saying, no, this isn't a haunted house tale so much as it is a story of addiction.
Yeah, especially if your point of view is centered from a character that could be considered an unreliable narrator.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And I see how that's more artistically invigorating. That's, you know, particularly for King, who was battling addiction at the time when that novel was written.
Yeah, but it's also really hard to translate from written word to the screen. So, okay, that makes sense why Kubrick would have done it that way.
Well, even, you know, the casting of Jack Nicholson, King famously said, the problem with the casting of the Kubrick film is that Jack, from the very get-go, seems crazy. From the very first scene, he's all smarmy, and he's got this little grin to everything, and he just seems like the big bad wolf character right out of the gate. So he's like, you know, you don't get to see him, you don't get to see this innocent man eaten away and turned into a monster. He's a monster from the beginning. So, I mean, I kind of see his point there, but I don't know. It's such an incredible performance. How can you deny it?
I mean, I always thought that Jack Torrance was an asshole.
Yeah.
I've never at any point in time thought of him as an interesting or likable character, but I guess you're not really supposed to, although it's probably easier to have sympathy for him in the novel if you see him, like, pre-Overlook, and he's, you know, maybe not the best guy in the world, but he's not coming after his wife and child with an axe, so, you know.
Well, I will agree that, you know, he is much more sympathetic in the novel, even though we are told about the incident of him picking Danny up too quickly and dislocating his arm. It's like, that's pretty severe, you know, and, but, you know, there is a lot about the novel that makes us more sympathetic to him. That's not to discount any of the negative things that he does pre-Overlook, but yeah, it's, that's an interesting thing, is that, you know, yeah, and I see how in a 2-hour film, you really don't have that breadth of time to get to know him before, and maybe that's the issue, is that, you know, maybe King would have been more favorable if Kubrick had added 30 minutes to the film and had the pre-Overlook days of Jack as a school teacher and all of the trials and tribulations he had been having up to that point. You know, follow all of that and focus a little bit on his addictions and then have the job interview. But, you know, that's kind of the apples and oranges thing about comparing film adaptations, is that with film, particularly screenplay structure, there's always this really strong push, you know, get where you're going in the story. Don't open with something and build up to that point. You don't want to spend the first act meandering up to back. You don't want that to all be backstory. It's better to cut into the action within the first 10 minutes and reveal backstory through dialogue and through things that are, you know, the way the character reacts to situations as you move along, rather than front-loading it, because that's a lot for an audience to sit through.
I just think we should only ever adapt books to be miniseries. Just feel like there's always so many details in books, and you just have to butcher so much when you are like, hey, we got 2.5 hours for this 500-page novel, whereas I feel like you could just get more in if you did a miniseries.
You know what I think is the best? I don't. This has never, to my knowledge, has ever been replicated, and I don't understand why. In this day of media being so ripe and rich for this, why this has not continued? But the Salem's Lot miniseries, which I consider the Salem's Lot film to be one of the finest adaptations of King's work, you know, probably second only to The Shining. Why this has not been replicated, I don't know, but it needs to happen again. Particularly with something like The Dark Tower, I know there was some talk about this, but with Salem's Lot, it was first adapted as a miniseries. So you had a good 3.5 hours collectively spread out over, you know, it was a 3-night affair when it premiered, and I remember when it premiered and just being in awe of it. I was allowed to watch that because it was on television, but it was one of the most amazing things. And then relatively soon after, if not concurrently, it was edited down to a 2-hour feature put into theaters in the UK and Germany. So now you can pick and choose when you watch the film. Do you watch the 3.5-hour miniseries cut, or do you watch the 2-hour theatrical one? And they both have their pluses and minuses, but at least there's a fidelity to the source that you get in a greater sense with the first one, and where you get a more like pat theatrical feature experience with the second.
That is really an interesting take. I didn't know that was a thing, that was even an option.
Yeah, it's very bizarre that that's never happened since, because it seems to be the best possible construct for these sort of things. Because, you know, most audience members would say, oh my god, you know, people, I don't know, on one hand people will say that any movie over 2.5 hours is too much, and They just don't have time for it, but then they'll sit and binge 4 or 5 hours of a Netflix series all at once and think nothing of it. But I'm just thinking, if you give people options, like, you know, here, you can have a 4-hour cut of this story. Or if you really don't care about the story that much, to that degree, here's what you might see in a theater that you would be fine with. I don't know if it has to do with the environment you see the film in. Like, maybe if people feel like, you think it'd be the opposite. You'd think if they're getting all ready to go to the theater, getting it in their mindset, clearing their schedules, meeting up with people, having dinner beforehand, you'd think going to the theater would be a very long, sort of drawn out experience where you'd want to take in as much of the story as possible. And then, I don't know. I'm completely off about these things. You know, I have no problem. Like, you know, one of my most favorite films is my copy of the Watchmen from, it's the director's cut plus the whole pirate's tale that's interwoven. The entire cut is almost 3 hours, 45 minutes. For me, you know, I love watching that. And I would have loved to have seen the film that way in the theater. But, you know, we were given a 2-hour cut. I don't know. I'm continually puzzled as to what people expect in terms of running length. But
I feel like that probably plays a role in why there's a fan edit community, too.
Yeah. It's very good you bring that up, because, you know, that's where my headspace has been for the past couple of years. It's what my dissertation is on, is the fan edit community and everything that's afforded by that. It's undeniable. You can't, you know, look away. I mean, when you really dig into the study of film, it's something that you know, there is a great need for people to explore different variations on stories and, you know, what suits people best. You know, some stories are better told in shorter formats, and some need that sort of padding, the length that a miniseries can afford. Or even, you know, something like the Game of Thrones, which, you know, of course you're adapting multiple novels then you know, need multiple seasons over a decade.
I had a thought. I think of super cool things to say, and then I get so distracted by what you're saying that by the time you're done, I've forgotten that I'm the one who looks like an idiot.
So I have to be more brief. I do get a little long-winded.
But, I don't know, I was just thinking about the fan edit community and how, you know, I guess when we take that into consideration, we sort of unofficially have those options. They're just a little limited, and they might be hard to find for, like, a layperson who's not super intensely into film and, like, trying to find alternate cuts of whatever, you know.
Yeah, even 20 years out. 20 years out of fan edits being a common thing, I would say 99% of the people on the street have no clue they even exist, which is weird. Like, I don't even know how to reconcile that. I don't understand it. But
yeah, because everybody loves movies, but at the same time, that's such a niche, like, interest in community that needs more attention. But that's why you have people like you that write their thesis papers over it.
You would have to be a very hard, it's like, you would have to be, I mean, if you're not just into film generally, you would have to be very hardcore into a thing. Like, okay, for example, with The Shining, and this only came to me because of the research I've been doing. With The Shining, there is a cut called The Shining forwards and backwards cut, or, you know, something like, it's just a really, you know, lame sort of, I mean, for lack of better terminology, the forwards and backwards cut. Basically, if you take The Shining, as this fan editor did, and you overlay the same movie on top of it, but running backwards, every scene of the film, And I may even, you know, I own it, but I've yet to watch it. I'm going to watch it in the next couple of days. But every scene matches up with what's happening in reverse.
How did he even discover that?
I don't know.
How did the sound engineer that worked on The Shining even accomplish that? I have so many questions. What witchcraft?
Okay, not sound-wise, but just visually. Like, the story is set, and this is why Kubrick was such a genius. I mean, to anyone out there who has seen the Room 237 documentary, which, to me, some people write it off and they're like, those people are way out there, that's too much, but, you know, that's just the terrain of, that's the terrain of film education, you know, that, to me, that's like an intro class where you're talking about that kind of stuff. The sort of theoretical applications that you can glean from a film, you find it in spades with Kubrick, particularly in The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut. But, you know, to not only be making all these social statements visually beyond, okay, you're adapting a story, that should be enough. But then he layered on all these other layers of meaning socially. And then on top of that, he's got this whole grand construct, presumably, this had to be intentional, that it's a complete Ouroboros, that, you know, the beginning connects with the end and vice versa, and that if you play them back to back, you know, that one in reverse, it's matching content precisely.
Oh my gosh. And see, this is why we need to have a bigger disconnect between how we treat adaptations, like, in general. Because the written word and, like, visual adaptations, they have so many different potentials. But those potentials are vastly different from one another. Because, again, as forms of media, very different. Not similar at all, and can evoke different emotions out of people using different methods.
Yeah.
It was mind-blowing. I didn't know any of that. That was bonkers.
Yeah, this points out to me, we should do a with this format, we can easily do a commentary. We should watch that one in particular and talk through it. Do a whole commentary on the backwards and forwards version of The Shining.
I'd be down.
That'd be cool.
I want to see this fan edit.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard to track down, but I finally did it, and it's, yeah, just from what I've sampled so far, I was blown away. I was like, this is too, you know, are you familiar with the Dark Side of the Moon edit of Wizard of Oz?
Isn't that just where when you play the Dark Side of the Moon and start the Wizard of Oz at the beginning at the same time, the album matches up with the movie?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, it's, that is uncanny. But and there are a couple of things like that out there, and this is one of them. But yeah, this is right in line with all of that.
Conspiracy, or people just paying really close attention to detail and thinking, oh, no one else will notice. I'll just do this for fun.
I mean, who would I just can't even imagine that Kubrick was actively aware of this, because he would have to know that decades would pass before anyone would notice, and only because technology would have progressed to a certain point that they would have the ability to just wantonly say, hey, what happens if you reverse this film backwards and overlay it on top of the forward presentation? Like, it's such a, I don't know, it's such a long shot that you would base your production of an entire millions of dollar level film with a major studio all on this lark of art for art's sake. I can't imagine. You know, how much of it is serendipity? I can't imagine. You know, when you really watch the Dark Side of the Moon cut of Wizard of Oz, it's too much. Like, you are just, it's just, you cannot deny the coincidences. But, I mean, the band, they say, no, you know, that's complete happenstance. That's nice, it matches up, but it wasn't intentional. And you have to wonder how much of that is just downplaying, because, I mean, sometimes it's too on point. It's amazing.
I don't know. It's up there with, how do people find those weird, super crazy video game Easter eggs where you have to, like, hit a bunch of buttons in a very specific order?
Right.
or you have to do this complicated jump move in this very particular spot, yeah. And then XYZ happens. I don't know. I'm glad that it happens, don't get me wrong, but I just wonder what the lines of thinking are that lead to these decisions.
Yeah, you know, with like the Zelda series, there's a YouTuber who has been debunking a lot of, or not debunking, he's been exploring a lot of these video game mysteries of classic Nintendo 64 games, and, you know, it's like, these are games that I spent hundreds of hours on, you know, such as Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, you know, Super Mario 64, and it's like, I made sure that I put in, you know, there's a reason I put in hundreds of hours on those, because I was actively making sure that I explored every nook and cranny of these entire worlds. But then here's this guy blowing me away by saying, what about the mystery of such and such, and blah, blah, you know, and he's doing these whole videos where it's like he's doing things that, like, you would have had to have spent thousands of hours in these worlds before you would even begin to think about doing some of the things he's pulling off. You know, finding these weird glitches in the games that reveal more about the story, or, you know, that reveal more about the limitations of the time period the games were made in. Like, I can't even reconcile. It's like, I already feel like I more than put in what any reasonable person would put in on some of these titles. And then this guy's blowing me away like 10 times over with his stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, there's always an audience out there that will consume so much more than what you can create. So it's like, Kubrick was just ready-made for that in a way, which is partially, you know, why he rode so high on the coattails of some of the stuff he did. I mean, it's not knocking his own, you know, obviously he was a genius, you know, in his own right, but, you know, particularly when he's riding on the story of King, wow, he, you know, he was really riding high.
Yeah. We need to bring this back to Dr. Sleep, because I don't know, I feel like we got off on The Shining super hardcore, and then somehow got onto video games, which was my bad. I did that. That was my fault.
Well, what, you know, what about, though, I mean, that's the thing, is that you can't get away from Dr. Sleep without talking about all these sort of intentional call-outs to Kubrick. For you, you know, if your first impressions of the story was that original 97 miniseries with Rebecca De Mornay, what about the visual cues for you resonated, and what was maybe distracting? I mean, were there any distractions? How did all that factor in for you?
I mean, honestly, since the last version that I watched was the Kubrick version, and that's the version I've seen way more often because the miniseries is, as you said, not that great. There weren't any visual cues for me to look for in the context of, like, that version of it. I was totally eyeballing every hint that I could find for the Kubrick one. You know how happy I got when I finally saw that carpet? I was like, yes! It's about to get real.
Well, the opening scene has the carpet design, like, very blatantly, and I couldn't believe, like, how blatant it was. I'm like, wow! This is a love letter to the original film.
With oh, yeah, that. I love that they recreated the tricycle shot.
Well, not only that, but, like, the elevator scene. I mean, everything, like, every one of the major rooms in that film was recreated by hand, like, just, I mean, they went off the original blueprints. It was all exact. It was precise. It was amazing how much love and detail went into the recreation of all that.
I'm hoping that people, even though, well, I don't know what it would have been like to go to Dr. Sleep with, like, no really, like, no specific clue on The Shining. I wish I could just forget about the Kubrick version just for a second and watch Dr. Sleep and see how that changes my experience.
I've been wondering the same thing myself. That's my number one burning question. Would this movie, it's such a powerful film, but would it hold any weight whatsoever if you didn't know The Shining? And if you specifically did not know the Kubrick version of The Shining, would it hold any weight? I'm sure some of our listeners may be in that boat, and I'd love to hear from them, but that, to me, is the most burning question I come away with. There is a brilliant video on YouTube, if any of you have not seen it yet, and you love King, and you love this adaptation of Dr. Sleep, Mike Flanagan and Kubrick, they meet for the first time, and this is funny to me, because Mike Flanagan already directed Gerald's Game, a King adaptation for Netflix a couple of years ago, and he, you know, had already completed work on Dr. Sleep when he meets up with King in a hotel lobby, and the two of them sit down together for an interview, and, you know, Flanagan is such a fan of both. You know, on the literature side, he was such a hardcore King fan. Visually, he was all about the Kubrick version of the film, and that's why he really convinced King on the need for them to go there to try to merge the two worlds finally, to say, look, these can coexist. There doesn't need to be this weird divide between the two. Here are the ways I propose that we marry the two together. And this video is amazing. You see the two of them together, and Flanagan's wearing an Apollo 11 t-shirt that emulates the sweater that Danny's wearing in the original film.
Aww.
And, you know, hearing King talk about the Kubrick film in a favorable way for the first time in decades is amazing. You know, and it's a really great video. You should check that out if you haven't seen it.
Well, preferably I wish that we could have these kind of, like, squad meeting, get together things every time that this came up in the industry. Like, you have two different directors working on two different parts, but it's the same overall story. And to get together and work on being able to come up with solid continuity and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, because I can tell that didn't happen with the Marvel movies.
I mean, how is it? That's what I have to question. How is it, if I were Mike Flanagan, and I hope to be in his shoes sometime soon, how would you direct? Like, Gerald's Game was one of King's more high-profile later works. How do you go about doing the adaptation of that film and not meet the director beforehand? Beforehand. And not, like, even on the set or something like that. Like, beforehand, how are you not just, like, invited to his house and you sit and have tea and you talk about this and you're, you know, you figure out his vision for the novel and all this kind of, like, it blows my mind that he did this whole adaptation, never having met him. He's named as director of Dr. Sleep for years. He does the whole movie without ever having met him. Then only after they do this little press thing where they finally meet together on camera. Like, how does that even happen? King's a very approachable person. I have a very good friend who, he was an actor in one of my first films, who just walked up to his gate and rang the doorbell and got in and spent the whole afternoon having coffee with him, like, in his home. Like, King is so approachable, it seems, that, like, it blows my mind that Flanagan had not met him in all that time.
Hey, if he has social anxiety like I do, I can tell you it's very easy to avoid meeting someone. Mm. If you really don't want to meet a specific person, it is very possible and easy to avoid. And maybe, but like, I don't know Mr. Flanagan. I don't know if he was just nervous and so he put it off, because that would have 100% been my excuse. I get really nervous.
You're probably right. I always just assume everyone's like me, and I'm just going to be bold, and I'm just going for what I want. Like, you know, me, like, I walked up to Anne Rice's door, and I just rang her doorbell, and I'm like, hey, I sent you a letter a few weeks ago. Can I come in, and let's have cookies and talk about your work? Like, I was totally, like, just bold and brash about it. And, you know, she was very kind, and she talked to me over the intercom and said, look, I'm going to send an assistant out to give you some autographs and everything, some goodies. And she sent this old man out who had a rubber bat wrapped around his head. That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. But, like, this kindly old man comes out, you know, and he's probably he was in his 80s at the time. He had this green rubber bat strapped around his head to deliver autographs to myself and the few friends I was with. I have to forget, you know, that's not most people.
No! I can tell you right now, I am never going to just go up to someone's house and ask if I can come inside. I'm never going to do that. I will watch you do that from really far away, far enough away so that people don't know that I know you.
Now, if I was just a fan, I would have said, no way would I do that. What do I have to offer? I'm a fan. But for me, I was, you know, at that point in time. And, you know, it's important never to lose this. You know, if you are trying to head into that field, you know, for me, I was thinking myself as a future peer. Like, I want to introduce myself. I want to announce myself. Like, look, you know, I'm doing this thing. I'm moving ahead. I'm, you know, I need tips. I need help. Like, you know, and it was sort of this idea of mentorship I was looking for. But, yeah, you know, I have to understand everyone's got a different approach.
I'll just write a book, and hopefully the book is good. And I'll just get my attention that way. I'd like for my work to speak for itself.
That's very good.
And I'll just network later. Mostly because if I try to think about the whole thing of like how to achieve this large grand goal, I get very overwhelmed. And so instead I just focus on, okay, what is the single next step that I can take to achieve this thing? And then I just don't worry about it.
Well, you're more centered than I am. You're like, let's do the things to give myself the credentials, and then we'll talk. And I've been, you know, relatively bold in saying, I just know this is going to be a thing, and I'm announcing myself. So you've been way more the more level out of the two of us.
And this is how we balance our friendship.
How we are the Scream Team.
Oh my gosh, yes. Absolutely.
All right, so there was something I wanted to bring up that I felt like was just, I think I lost it, just like you lost the thread earlier. It was like, to me, it was the most amazing thing of the film experience, Dr. Sleep. Give me just a moment, let me see.
We can fix all this in editing. Well, you can fix
what's
editing.
I can.
It would make me sound super smart in editing. Do you remember?
You know, let me just defer to you, because I do know something I want to bring up, but I want to bring it up a little bit later towards the end. Is there anything that you have burning that you came away with that? You know, like how did people generally respond in the theater? Your friend Ray, who attended the premiere with you, you know, how did she respond to it? You know, I'm just kind of interested in these very general sort of things right now.
During the I guess for lack of a better word, degloving scene in Ibra's weird mind filing cabinet room. Yeah. I just kept hearing Ray next to me going, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no. And I was like, ah, it's Gerald's game all over again. Because I have not read that short story, but I have watched that movie so many times.
See, I don't know a thing. I'm a huge King fan. I don't know anything about Gerald's Game. I haven't read the book or the, or you say it's a short story. I haven't read that. I haven't seen the film. I cannot wait now, because I have so much faith in Mike Flanagan. Like, I can't wait to read and then expose myself to that adaptation.
And Bruce Greenwood is, and Carla Gugino? I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Very pretty lady. And she is the main protagonist. And it's just so well shot. And it's visually really pretty. And very gory. If you're not a fan of, like, blood and watching truly unfortunate things happen to this poor woman that's been handcuffed to this bed, you might want to skip it. I really liked it, though.
Hmm.
Anywho.
What a crazy renaissance. Like, when I was in seventh grade in 1990, 1991, or I should say 89, yeah, it is 89, 90. What a crazy renaissance King is having. I remember at that point in time, King was at the height of his literary prowess in terms of being recognized in the mainstream media. kids at school were showing up with these King books, like all the smarter kids were showing up with these King books in tow. They'd be reading between, you know, assignments and stuff in class. And, you know, there was a television thing. Some people may remember this. There was a call-in number you could do. There was a commercial that was very pervasive at the time, around 89. The Stephen King Book Club. And they, you know, the cameraman comes up on this trench coat wearing, Pleon, who, that's my, I'm mixing words here. Plebeian, who has a trench coat on, and they say, "Hey, do you like scary stories? Do you like Stephen King?" And the guy's all like, all alarmed. Oh, don't scare me. Oh yes, I love him. I love to be scared. And they're like selling him on the idea of the Stephen King book club, where, you know, every month you get a different hardcover novel, and it was $24.99 a month or whatever it was back then. And it was like the height. At that moment, I saw that in seventh grade. I realized Stephen King had broke the common threshold of, you know, he became a household name in that moment. It's like, okay, he has enough of a corpus that, like, you know, anyone off the street, just like they're showing in this video, this commercial, they're showing anyone off the street will be familiar with his work. And not only have they read one book of his, but they'll be hungry for more. And I remember it was such a high point for him. And I thought, you can't get, like, he is riding this wave. And I remember lots of instructors at the time, both high school and then eventually college, arguing, Stephen King is a very popular author, but he'll never be remembered in the annals of English literature. You know, it was this very snobbish sort of attitude. And now that's completely reversed. Like, it's just a given now. Now that we're going through a secondary renaissance, thanks to the film adaptations, which started, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, there began to be enough of a upswell of adaptations that now it's very much recognized. Stephen King is not only a main staple of English literature in history going forward, but, you know, just acknowledging him in the here and now. It's weird that there's, like, there was a 20-year gap. There was so much hay made over everything he was doing at the time. There was a lapse of about 20 years, and now he's finally being codified again as sort of a master, you know, by the powers that be. It's interesting to me that someone would have two separate sort of periods of, you know, here he is in the later parts of his life. He's had a second upswell of popularity. Like, how lucky is this guy? His career has had, most people, you know, just live for that one little wave. And now here he's at a second one. It's incredible.
I mean, he's earned it. I mean, people don't, you know, necessarily have to love his books. I'm not asking anybody to drop everything they're doing and worship Stephen King, but, like, at this point, you can't deny the impact that he's had on the genre, and I think I look up to that more than anything, like, to be able to have influenced kind of how it grew.
You know, I have to, you know, I can't even put into words my feelings, because by my own admission, I would say he's probably my second favorite author ever, even though I have honestly only read, out of his 60-some-odd books, or however many there are, somewhere around that number, I've honestly only read probably a tenth of those. But the ones that I've read, every single one has been killer. They have been so indelible, I don't ever get them out of my head. They are vital. You know, and I do want to read them all, every single one of them, and I will. I think I'm moving into a phase of my life where that will be possible. But it's just, his influence knows no bounds. Like, I mean, he could have written just 3 of those novels, and he would be remembered hundreds of years into the future. And, you know, and I'm not just talking about his early novels, Carrie and Salem's Lot and Christine and, you know, The Shining. I'm talking about, The Green Mile in 97.
To me,
that, to me, the minute I read that novel, and I read it in chapbook form, most people, unless you lived during that time period in terms of a readership level, you don't know what that meant, but, like, it was such a thing. It was like he decided to reinvigorate Charles Dickens' level of readership, saying, hey, I'm a popular author. I'm going to give you my newest novel in chapbook form. So every week you can go to the store and buy another, penny dreadful. This is basically what it was. But we were paying 99 cents instead of a penny. But, you know, so every week you go out and you buy another installment in the penny dreadful he was putting out at the time, which was collectively The Green Mile. It was a 6-part series. I died. Every single week I went out, and the day it came out, I had the newest installment in hand, and I read it. It was 80 to 90 pages in length, each little chapbooks, and I adored it. And when I heard there was a film adaptation in the works, I was over the moon. I tried to get on, I auditioned to be like a background extra for like the execution scenes and all this stuff. I was so invested. And that movie, I mean, to this day, The Green Mile is probably my second or third favorite film ever. Like, I think it is so well done.
It makes me cry.
Oh, it's so amazing. And I don't know why people are so, you know, The Shawshank Redemption seems to be the get-go film for, like, not only film, but, like, film adaptations. But I'm like, The Green Mile is, like, Shawshank, but on such a much deeper level. Like, it's 5 times more potent and powerful because of all the supernatural elements that it involves. So I don't understand, like, why The Green Mile isn't the high mark. Because how much deeper can you get when you also involve all these supernatural elements on top of just our day-to-day existence? Maybe most people aren't into supernatural sort of things, and they just want to stay very real world, and that's why Shawshank's such a phenomenon. For me, like, you can't do any better as a King adaptation than The Green Mile. And, rivaled only, of course, by The Shining. So the fact that Dr. Sleep had such a resonance with me, you know, to really contest either one of those in my book was huge. So, anyway, I've dithered a little bit. what are some things that you picked up on, like, structurally, in terms of just the story? Like, where did you, okay, so you not having read the novel, like, how did you approach this in terms of, oh my gosh, so I'm about to see a sequel to The Shining. You had seen several different adaptations of it. Like, for you, what was it like to look at this character and see where he was and where he ended up, how he kind of weathered through things, you know, like how the story became one from like a haunted house tale to more of a sort of a vampiric chase sort of story. You know, what was that like for you?
Well, my first biggest impression was, oh, I'm not surprised at all that he became an alcoholic. Like, Danny having, like, going through that rough patch where he's, like, homeless, and he's drinking all the time, and he's stealing that dude's money, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, this is realistic. I get really, really tired of stories that present, like, a character who's going through some stuff, and, like, yeah, they survived, but I feel like in the real world, one of my, like, friends went through stuff like that, they would not be okay on the other side. And so I was like, okay, good. This is how trauma realistically manifests in the waking world. So this makes sense that, yeah, Danny, you know, went down a path that, you know, was not a super great life decision. But I loved the guy that helped him once he got into Frasier. And I love that he found, like, his AA group and he found his buddy. So, yeah. I like that it did have an upswing. Like,
yeah.
It was in the mire, but it didn't stay down in the mire. Because that is, you know, it's on the other end of the scale. Like, that's boring. You can't be on either side for too long. You have to have a little bit of both to have
story. You know, I have to say, that was my biggest critique of any of the Iron Man movies and anything involving the Tony Stark character. My biggest critique, which was rich from the beginning, you know, with Iron Man 1, was that they did not focus enough on his alcoholism. And I understand they were trying to appeal to a lot of kids, but it's like, when I think Tony Stark, the first thing that pops into my mind is not Iron Man, it's alcoholism. Alcoholism is the biggest demon he faces, and it's not any of these characters that he faces off in the comics. Like, these are all low level to him. You know, he just goes out and he deals with it. You know, the bigger demon for him to battle is not any of these supernatural or alien creatures. It's alcoholism. And to me, growing up, reading comics about Iron Man, that was the thing to focus on. And Marvel shied away from that in such a big way, it turned me off. I wanted to see an Iron Man story that was all about his battles with alcohol. I didn't want to go see him off saving cities or fighting Thanos or whatever. I wanted to see him overcome his alcohol addiction. But Marvel shied away from that in such a big way. And it gets under my skin. I can't understand why that was not addressed. Because to me, that's far more powerful and more human and relatable than anything else. And I loved, because to me, aside from the Iron Man comics, the Dr. Sleep novel, which tackles the idea of alcoholism and people going to therapy for it and everything, and the struggle that they face on a day-to-day basis, the Dr. Sleep novel gave me that in spades. I hold on to that as, like, the paramount for me of, like, the best novel for an alcoholic to read in terms of encouragement. Like, you know, this is how bad it can be, and you can overcome this. You know, I wanted to see that on screen. And I would say Mike Flanagan covered it about 50% of what it is in the novel. He did a pretty good job of it. There was, there was a key moment in the film where he really went there, where it's like, okay, is he really going to give in after all this time? And he, you know, our good hero, kept it together. And everyone, I imagine, cheered at that moment. But, that's where I'm coming from with this.
An unpopular opinion that is not important at all, but I'm going to say it. I hated that lady's dumb hat.
And you did! Oh my gosh!
Special be explained about the hat, and we got nothing. And I was like, oh, okay, so is that just her whimsical, like, boho accessory? Why? What is so special about the hat? And it looks stupid. I don't like top hats.
I will say, in the novel, it makes out like her hat is like a traditional top hat, like the full-on thing. And all of the True Knot members, in the novel, they are much more like they're meant to emulate Good Sam's members.
That's a Good Sam member.
Oh, you know, they're, you know, Winter Texans and Winter Floridians. There's a whole staple of Midwest people who, in their 50s and 60s, they decide with their campers and RVs and everything, they're just going to, like, travel from state to state and stay current with what's, like, warm. Like, that's all that matters. And they're going to, like, you know, they stay at the same campsites. And if they're a Good Sam's member, like, you can kind of trust them because they're, like, you're legit, you're paying a monthly fee and stuff. And it basically shows this fat guy's face with a halo over it. And so if you're a Good Sam's member, you're kind of like you're a good person to know. My grandparents were part of this for decades. In the novel, it very much plays into that. It's all about, you read, you know, that's one thing about the novel I didn't like, is that it's all about, in the novel, it's all about these very sort of like, the True Knot comes off as very, as a very sort of elderly sort of thing. You know, they go to Walmart and they, you know, make their daily grocery runs, and they've got, you know, it's just a so, you know, they're talking about all the times about Netflix and stuff. There's one line in the movie where Crow mentions this. He says a little bit of dialogue that includes like how out of touch the True Knot are with changing technology and culture, and he mentions Netflix. He's like, I don't know what they're up to these days, but they're Netflix and stuff. You know, it's like, the novel's rife with that stuff, and it's like kind of eye-rolling for people, I think, that are of a certain generation. It's like, you know, what? It just sounds like an old man banging their drum about the way things are changing, and it's not even that accurate. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's that's what it is. It's just kind of an old sort of club that you could belong to. It's really fallen out of favor. I don't know why. I don't know if Airbnb changed all that or what, but Good Sam's really isn't a thing anymore so much. Cue an email from Good Sam saying, we're very much here.
I dug the main lady's aesthetic, though.
No, about the top hat thing, though, you know, I thought it was cheesy in the novel when I read it. I was like, really? Okay, top hat, you know, it just seemed too much. You know, and but it was a break apart from the whole white trash sort of trappings that the rest of the True Knot was. But, you know, when I saw her on screen, it worked so well. Like, it was one of the rare things that was described in the novel that I saw on screen that I was just totally on board with, because it defined her as, I could see her as a very alluring, sexy character. I mean, without it, she was still that. She was still magnetic, but she needed something to kind of define her as sort of an icon. And for me, anyway, you know, just having that, and thank goodness it wasn't a top hat. It was just kind of a little like half top hat thing. It was just her little signature thing that gave her some character. I really did dig that, and I thought that, you know, if this movie had been released when it should have been released a few weeks before Halloween, I think a lot of women would have been walking around wearing that getup. Probably not as well. Definitely not as well. She, Rebecca Ferguson owned the film, in my opinion.
She did give a really good performance, and the little girl that played Abra also did a really good job.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's Ewan McGregor, who's perfect. Just, you know, walking around being perfectly normal. So.
Well, Kylie Curran, who played Abra, did an amazing performance. And I'll get back to that in a moment. That's a big thing for me, and I'm not going to harp on it, but it was a big realization. It was a big Damon evolving moment. In terms of McGregor, I have to admit, I was very sore for a long time at the, I was very offended at the idea that they did not call upon Danny Lloyd to reprise his role, because he played Danny in a Kubrick film. Like, I mean, if you're in a Kubrick film, like, there's no chance of that ever again. But if you were, you're pretty much sainted as an actor or actress, I would imagine. You know, I really took issue with the fact that they are not going with Danny Lloyd as the character. But I don't, this is not a moment where you kowtow to Hollywood royalty. You go with what's right. The one and only film he ever did as an actor, because his parents submitted him for it, was The Shining. He did that. And then he did one minor film for television soon after. And that was it. And then he went on with his life and he became a teacher. And he does his best to try to hide his acting past, which has gotten to the point now where he says he can't control it anymore. particularly the older students, know who he is and what his past is, and they bring it up during class, and to him he just sees it as a big distraction. But I really wanted to see him in this film as that character. Now, I don't know, you probably didn't catch it, but he's in the film. And when he appeared on film, I was electric. I was like, whoa! I knew exactly, within half a second, I knew it was him, and I turned to the person I was seeing the movie with, and I said, look, it's Danny! It's him! It's the original Danny! That's him! Like, he was playing the baseball player's dad in the bleachers, going on about his kid.
Oh, okay.
He's like, oh, watch him! It was kind of an awkward moment. Like, you would never put this in ordinarily. This is how you can always tell it's like a cameo appearance. Like, this, it would have never been there otherwise. It was just an awkward moment of a parent goofing off about their kid. Oh, here he comes. He's really doing great this year. I can't wait to see what's coming next. Let's see. You know, it's a very awkward sort of shot. It lasted no more than 10 seconds. But there he was. I really wanted him to do it. But yeah, he acknowledged, he said, look, I'm not an actor. I did that one film at my parents' behest. It's just not my life. That's not what I chose to do. I'm not an actor. So they pick Ewan McGregor, which is not a bad choice. He's one of my favorite actors. So, you know, that was pretty cool that he took over. I still don't think Ewan McGregor was the best choice. He did a great job, though. But yeah, I mean, I loved the Easter egg there that Danny Lloyd is still on screen in the film.
Yeah, if someone remember that actors don't owe us anything.
They don't. Like, they never do.
If he doesn't want to come back, then we can't make him come back, no matter how cool it would have been.
They are the most malleable bunch. Like, you can't. It's like freaking Jodie Foster on Hannibal. She didn't like the script. She didn't like the source novel, so she said no. And so, you know, she was replaced. And, you know, for better or for worse, she was replaced.
I still haven't seen Hannibal.
Are you kidding? Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Don't yell at me. I'm sorry.
I'm not yelling. I know. I love it. I love it. I love it.
It's on my list of things to watch because I really love Mads Mikkelsen and, what is his name? Hugh Darcy? What is the name of the guy that plays Will?
Watch me be completely wrong, and that's just the name of something else that I made up. Anywho.
And you're talking about the movie, right? From 2001.
No, I'm talking about the TV series.
Oh, the TV, sorry. No, I was talking about the movie. Yeah, with yeah.
See, this is why this is sometimes hard to do when I can't see you.
Yeah, we need to do this in the future from PubW.
I don't know how I feel about recording a podcast at a really public place.
Well, you know, they play their music way too loud. I'll say that. Yeah. You know, Will Graham, played by Hugh Dancy. He's the regular in the series, which, you know. Hey, they are reviving the series.
Nice.
Oh my gosh, because you know what? They were about to tackle the Silence of the Lambs era. You know, we're going into, we're finally going into the Silence of the Lambs era, and hopefully they'll move ahead to the Hannibal era too. Like, I am so jazzed about that. Wow. No, it's amazing to me. Like, I am such a Hannibal, you know, freaking love young Hannibal, even like the you know, I'm coming from the creator himself, like the novel of that, I read it, it makes so much sense to me, like it's so dead on. But again, that has nothing to do with Dr. Sleep. One thing I want to talk about Dr. Sleep is, and I'm gonna play this for you right now, I'm pulling it up at the moment. This is a major thing in the Dr. Sleep novel. And so much that I fully expected for months on end that when we finally saw this film, we would hear this song not just once, but many, many times. And it didn't even make it the cut. He talks about the fact that Abra, that she basically is triggered by this song. In this bridge, this Beatles bridge. Have you heard anything about this?
No.
The novel goes into a lot of history about Abra, about her grandmother, about her mother, about her childhood, about her growing up. And so, you know, it became very natural that if you're a fan of this novel, you were expecting that at some point you would have this sort of callback in audio form. There were times I'd be on the bus, I'd be in Belfast on my way to like Derry, and I was reading this novel then, and I would read that they were going to Enid, Oklahoma, and I would about lose it on the bus. I'd be like, oh my gosh, what? Like, I couldn't even handle it. To me, it was like, whoa, he's moving out of Maine territory, he's going to Oklahoma now. You know what's funny, though, is that I had a friend recently post something about some of King's more latent works, where he has started to use Oklahoma, for whatever reason, he started to use Oklahoma much more as a base of operations for a lot of his stories. And he apparently, in these last couple of novels, has referred to Oklahoma City in a slang way of saying Okie City. Okie City.
Does he know that literally no one says that?
And that's the funny thing. This person who brought it up was like, oh my gosh, what the heck is this man doing? Like, no. No one in Oklahoma ever says Okie City.
No.
But
now to him, I'm curious to see how he's portraying our home state in his books. So.
But to him, he thinks that's a thing.
Where did he get it from?
Okay, there is a reason why in Vicky King's book, you know, it's all about, you know, how to write a film from the heart. It's all about how do you write about what you know. Like, you write about your own geography. You don't try to pretend to know anything about the rest of it. It's like, she's very right in that. Like, because, you know, he wrote about Maine. And you know, he basically, he that was his main thing. It was like, he was all about, you know, trying to, you know, he could write about Maine as a thing. But he wasn't ever able, you know, you go outside of that, he loses his credence. He starts writing about Oklahoma, and he starts having characters talk about Okie City. It's like, no, that's not what we call Oklahoma City. We just call it the city. You know, so I had some friends point that out. And it was really funny to me when I first encountered this. I decided, I was like, you know what, Stephen King kind of deserves it. Like, why don't I, when I become a really big film director, I'm just gonna blanketly refer to Oklahoma City as Okie City, in reference to King having done it. And I'll say, you know what? King was completely off base, out of his mind, didn't know what the heck he was referencing, but that's what he said that seemed natural, so I'm going with it too. Join me on this quest. What do you think about that?
No!
No!
How about we don't write anything where anybody calls Oklahoma City that? Because nobody says that.
It is pretty horrible, isn't it? Okie City. Now, I was surprised when he describes Enid, you know. He doesn't really describe it. He just says they're in Enid, Oklahoma. A couple of times. I think there are two instances in the novel. They go to Enid, Oklahoma.
would love to read how he describes the town.
But that's the thing. That's not the thing. He doesn't describe it. He just says, and now they're in Enid, Oklahoma, and they do this whole thing.
Like, there's no description for the setting?
No.
Except for that one sentence?
No, well, you know, other than the general, he's probably relying upon the previous descriptions of cornfields. Like, I am so sick to death of people thinking Oklahoma is just a bunch of cornfields. In fact, when the Watchmen series came out 2 weeks ago, I was very vocal about it on social media. I'm like, thank God, finally, we have a series that's not only acknowledging Oklahoma history, but it's like not including cornfields. We are including the Tulsa race riots of 1921. I felt like that pilot, to me, did so much for Oklahoma on film. We're a very unique thing with five different ecosystems. How did you feel about... So, having been most familiar with the film adaptation of The Shining, how did you feel about the sort of visual recreations of that, the sort of continuation of that storyline? You know, what to that resonated with you?
Well, I was really happy when we got to go back to the Overlook.
Okay.
Like, that whole, Danny's whole logic for why they would go back, I was like, okay, I hadn't considered that, and that makes sense. And I'm proud of you for thinking of it. And they kept the iconic carpet, and there were several rooms that I recognized. And then there were other parts where it just seemed like generic old building. Uh-huh. I don't know if that was just... they were only going to have, like, a few key scenes with the iconic stuff from the Kubrick film in there. And the rest of it was just going to be running around an old building. But I still did really like it. I was bummed about the ending when Danny kind of got reduced to being Abra's weird imaginary friend.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Dick was to him for a while.
Yeah.
Mostly because I just really liked Ewan McGregor as Danny. I thought he did a really good job. And so I never want to see characters that I like die. But unfortunately, especially in this genre, that's not a wish that normally gets granted to me. So you gotta suck it up and move on.
Yeah.
And but I was the most thankful for watching his arc of, like, making bad life choices and going the bad way, and then he just meets the right person at the right time, and then everything.
Yeah.
It's okay. Of course, this does mean that everything goes to shit again, as it does. But we got to see, like, him overcome other stuff that wasn't necessarily even that supernatural. Like, that's just life.
Yeah.
And I think that rounded out his character a little bit better. And sidebar, Ray and I actually talked about this the other day, how in most horror movies, when there's silverware on the ceiling, it's like knives.
Yeah.
But this was a little kid. We really thought that choosing spoons instead kind of fit the aesthetic.
Yeah, and that was very much a part of the novel. And that's, coincidentally, that's one of the parts of the novel I expected not to be part of the film. I was very surprised with that. But yeah, that was great. All right, so I guess, you know, just on the means of tying things up, I know Warner Brothers a couple of years ago had kind of set out, I don't know if this is their current agenda, but it was as of a couple of years ago when they first made alliances with King's Camp. They also said, we're going to make this part of a franchise. We're going to do a whole Overlook movie. We're going to do a whole movie prequel that's all about the, you know, presumably, we're assuming, this will be about the previous caretakers of the Overlook. So we're talking about Horace Derwent and, you know, all these people who were part of that original 1920s team that hosted people in this very remote mountain region. I've been to this hotel, by the way. To me, it's amazing. I love it. I've been there several times, in fact. But anyway, from Warner's perspective, they have wanted to sort of milk this sort of association that King has had with the property. He was on that property for all of, you know, a few nights. He and Tabitha stayed there, and he was you know, basically using them as a resource for his writing. They've been wanting to milk this and turn it into a sort of franchise. That's why the current posters say an overlooked story. They're wanting to do something more with this in the future. Presumably they're wanting to go back to the 1920s and talk about the stories of Horace Derwent and, you know, the caretaker and, you know, the whole family then. You know, I'm sure it's going to happen, you know. Whether or not it will be anywhere as good as Kubrick's version or Mike Flanagan's version, it's up for grabs. What do you think about all this?
Well, for every place that's super mega haunted is a story about how that place got super mega haunted. Except for, because, like, no place is built haunted except for maybe the Winchester House.
Yeah, right.
But that's the whole... The construction of that was just bonkers, and unless, like... Unless the Overlook was somehow just built haunted, like it just came that way. I don't know anything about the construction of the Overlook Hotel, but that means that that's something that I would hope that a prequel would explore. And I would be curious to see how many elements of the history behind the Stanley Hotel they borrow. Because isn't that the hotel that the Overlook is based off of?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's based on that. You know, the Kubrick version used exteriors from a location up in Oregon. But the actual place that King lived in was room 201 in the actual location. And you can rent a room there, and it's supposed to be haunted and all that. You've had some great insight on Dr. Sleep, and hopefully I have as well. Do you have anything else to add to the overall reaction to the story?
Really good movie. If you like The Shining, you'll like Dr. Sleep. If you like Ewan McGregor, you will like Dr. Sleep. But don't go in expecting to come out horrified, because it's not really that kind of movie.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah, definitely not that kind of movie. Yeah. I think the best horror films are not those. You know, it's like there are very, 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 very few that you actually come out of horrified. It's not like a It's not like going to a horror house. It's more about the story, and that's what matters. It's long term. It's a kind of a slow burn haunt. So anyway, yeah. I'm glad to hear your thoughts, and hopefully that some of what we've said collectively will have some resonance with people. And I can't wait to get this out there and hear some responses.
Oh God, I'm nervous again.
No,
it's okay. No. I just need more practice.
We're just two people who, you know, we come from completely different points of attraction. We're both responding to the same thing. Like, you know, it's like, here's who we are. We're owning it. We're horror fans, first and foremost, at all that matters. And here's our thoughts. And if anyone has a question or a comment, we will address that. I didn't think
that's
that
one of the great things about horror is everyone's going to relate to it in a different way.
Yeah, for sure.
There's room always... for everyone at the table.
Yeah. Lots and lots and lots and lots of different perspectives. All right. Thank you so much. And
until next time, happy screaming.
We will see you again on a future episode.
Hell yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.